I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, the latest in our series of conversations about things you just should not say to your colleagues of diverse backgrounds. Today, we'll ask our expert what kinds of things you should never say to your white coworkers. That's a little later. But first, we want to talk about an important cultural milestone. Remember this? If you do, then you probably remember it's from Spike Lee's 1989 film Do the Right Thing, a tale of racial and ethnic tensions reaching the boiling point in a multi-ethnic neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, all on the hottest day of the year. When it was released, Do the Right Thing won raves from some critics for its unflinching look at race and city life, but it was also panned by others as inflammatory, antisocial, and pointlessly bleak. Now, as is so often the way of the world, the film is seen as one of the most important of its era. And as this summer marks the 20th anniversary of the release of Do the Right Thing, it's time for a new look. In the latest of our series of collaborations with the online publication, TheRoot.com, we pulled together a panel of writers to talk about why the movie was so influential and whether it still resonates today. Joining us are Kai Wright, a senior writer for The Root, Natalie Hopkinson, associate editor for The Root, and author and professor Mark Anthony Neal, who teaches Black popular culture at Duke University and writes the blog New Black Man. All three contributed essays to a special Do the Right Thing series. Welcome. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Professor Neal, we're going to start with you. What is it that makes this film, first of all, tell us at the time this film emerged, what made it so powerful with the people for whom it particularly resonated?
It's the end of the late 1980s, and, you know, New York City has gone through some things with the killings of Michael Griffith and Michael Stewart and Eleanor Bumpers. Just a couple of months after the film is released, Yusef Hawkins is killed. You know, so racial
tensions
are...
These are all people who were killed.
African-Americans, right, who were either killed by mobs or whites or killed in acts of police brutality. So, you know, Black folks in the city of New York are on edge around these kinds of issues. And Spike Lee really puts his lens on some of those tensions. It's also a moment where hip-hop is suddenly getting into its own groove, and there's kind of a seismic shift taking place culturally, where you have now large groups of young African-Americans listening to hip-hop. And, you know, he also marks that in the film. The choice of Public Enemy and Fight the Power kind of resonates in a powerful way because of that.
Is it considered to be the first film that really made use of hip-hop, for whom it was just utterly indispensable, kind of put hip-hop out there?
In terms of broad mainstream American film, absolutely.
I think we should...
There have been hip-hop films before then, but this was the one that really utilized hip-hop in a way that spoke to where it lived in the world.
Race and the way race was lived, is lived, one might say, at least by some people, is central to this film. And I think we're going to go right there to a pivotal moment in the film where the police kill a young Black man while trying to restrain him. And the main character of Mookie, played by Spike Lee, then throws a garbage can through the window of the pizza shop where he worked. Let's play it.
They killed him. They killed Radio Raheem's
murder. They did it again, just like Michael Stewart.
Murder.
Do what you gotta do. Let's all go home. Somebody's gonna get hurt.
Yeah, you boy!
If we don't stop this and stop it now, we're gonna do something we're gonna regret for the rest of our lives. Sal and his boys had nothing to do with what the cops did.
And you hear the voice, of course, of Ossie Davis Jr. there, who plays one of the characters in the film. Natalie, your essay argues that Mookie's reaction is the wrong thing, was the wrong thing. But you're also very candid about how much you identified at the time with the rage that these characters express and the way they behave. Talk more about that.
Yeah, you know, I talk about it. I sort of read it back then. And now is a Black nationalist manifesto, you know, sort of a purging of elements out of the community that did not respect Black people and respect the Black presence in Bed-Stuy. And, you know, I definitely could identify with the rage. And, you know, I was growing up and going through my own rage in the suburbs. you know, and it really felt like cathartic to see that happen.
And you're not proud of that, actually, now.
Now I just, you know, I was young and, you know, it's just, it's kind of a short-sighted reaction to something that's really horrible that's going on. And, you know, when you're in the heat of the moment, You understand how these things happen. But looking back and being someone who lives in a community that's had to deal with the aftermath of these fires so many decades later, it actually angers me now because, you know, you're not realizing that the people who are going to have to live with the consequences of that, and they are not white. It's us.
You talk about how there are just some moments in the film that are cringeworthy in retrospect, where you talk about this one character bugging out who is begging the pizza owner to put a picture of somebody black on his wall. And we have that clip, and we'll play it.
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
What did that say to you?
Yeah, again,
and what does it say to you then, and what does it say to you now?
Again, then, you know, like there were a lot of battles over representation and black people getting their recognition in society in general. Now, and you know, this is all, and my essay was definitely looking at through 2009 eyes. Today, it does feel, you know, like he's begging this white man to put, you know, a black picture on the wall when I'm just like, why don't you get your own restaurant? Why don't you put your own pictures up on the wall? You know, what a meaningless gesture to ask someone for. You know, why don't you ask for jobs? Why don't you ask for better schools? Why don't you ask for something that's a little bit more concrete than having a black picture on the wall?
And but I think what may be the most provocative part of the essay is you say it's time to invite Sal, who was the pizza owner whose shop was trashed in this as a pivotal scene in the film. It's time to invite him back into the neighborhood. Tell me about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. I mean, I talk a little bit in the essay about, you know, my experience in Bloomingdale in Washington, D.C., and we are begging a pizzeria to come in. We would love Sal to come in. And you know, we have to drive all the way across town to get a decent slice. And we would be very, very happy to have Sal back in the neighborhood. And there actually are remnants of an Italian-American presence in our neighborhood today. And, you know, they've held on over the decades, and they're not very visible. And it really is time to welcome them back into the neighborhood and bring them back into the fold. And, you know, for the communities to realize the multicultural, multi-ethnic place that they were always meant to be, or they could be.
Kai Wright, your essay is, how can we put it? It's not exactly an answer to Natalie's, but it kind of complements or it speaks to Natalie's perspective here. You are from Bed-Stuy, and the headline of your piece is Still Do or Die in Bed-Stuy. And you say that he captured something very real, and there's things that are still that way. Talk to me about that, if you would. And by the way, I'm also from Bed-Stuy. I thought I'd mention that.
Well,
so I can check you on your facts. But
well, I'm actually not from Bed-Stuy. I live there now for the last several years. I grew up like Natalie in the suburbs, having my little bit of rage. One of the things that's striking, I think, that I was trying to get at in the piece is that what was enduring about Spike's film is his portrait of the neighborhood as something more than a flashpoint of rage, right? So the film culminates in that moment. But throughout it, it's really quite a loving portrait of this quintessentially black neighborhood and all of this sort of push and pull that goes on inside it, the mix across classes and across lifestyles and across ages that you find in a place like Bed-Stuy. And that's still there today. And that's the positive part of it. And one of the things that I noticed, you know, coming from this suburban rage to make a life as an adult in a place like Bed-Stuy is how much living there defies some of those stereotypes about what a black neighborhood is. And so I think that was one of the most enduring parts about the film. That said, there is a bubbling tension in a place like Bed-Stuy that still exists today and that will always exist when you create these walled-off ghettos that are robbed of economic opportunity. And when you get a time like we're in now, where the economy is again turning up the heat, you start to see the tensions rise as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Mark Anthony Neal, Kai Wright, and Natalie Hopkinson. They've all contributed essays to the Root.com special commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the release of Do the Right Thing. Can I write, you say in the piece, I defy anyone to find 3 square miles with an equal density of hotness. Whether it's Sunday morning fashion, I swear I saw a dude on Easter with a red and purple suit that actually looked good, or a Saturday afternoon tank tops. I'm with Estelle. Don't like them baggy jeans, but I like what's underneath them.
That's right. It's a beautiful melange. It's just a beautiful place where everyone is figuring out how to get along with each other.
Are they though? Because one of the other points you make in the piece is that when times get tough, love and hate can feel like the same passion. Are people really trying to get along, or are they just there all in the same place?
Oh, no, I think they're trying to get along. And I think, again, that's one of the things that was great about the movie is that it showed, again, up until when things broke down, up until the point when love and hate get confused, everyone's actually working at being on the same page. People are trying to be neighbors and lovers and friends. And, you know, it doesn't always look good. The little dance that that the street corner wino was doing with the Asian American bodega owner doesn't always come out right. But they're doing a dance together and they're trying to figure out how to deal with each other. That's what community's about, is figuring it out.
Mark Anthony Neal, I wanted to ask about one of the other essays in the piece. You didn't write it. It talks about the women characters in Spike Lee's films overall and in this film in particular. Any thoughts you have about that? As significant as this film is, one of the things that some critics still talk about is just the what's up with these women characters who sort of exist to be kind of naked and shrill.
I mean, that's been the most enduring critique of Spike Lee's films, his inability really to draw full portraits of women and little girls in these films. And Do the Right Thing, you know, in that regard, is just as bad or problematic as some of the other films are. When you think about, you know, Mookie's partner, she's not fully developed. We get no sense of even the reason why they're together, except for the fact that they have a child. And, you know, the relationship between Sal and Mookie's sister, it also is very, very uncomfortable. You know, here you have a 50-plus Italian-American white man, and you're dealing with an African-American female. And while the fact that it's black and white is not as problematic, particularly in 2009, you do get the sense that this is a man who's harbored emotions for this young woman since she was a little girl. I mean, it's just something very uncomfortable about that. In the opening scene when Mookie himself is with Jade, his sister, and you know, for a couple of moments, you're not quite sure what the nature of their relationship is. Even at this point in time, you know that's Gerard Lee, and you know that's Spike Lee, you know that they're brother and sister, and it's just really an uncomfortable moment in that context of the film.
But given Natalie's point that this is kind of a black nationalist manifesto in some ways, is there some larger issue around the relationships between African-American men and women that this film brings out?
Oh, I think absolutely. You know, the thing that we should expect Spike Lee to carry, you know, the bloodstained banner, if you will, for full representations of black women, I mean, he's obviously not capable of doing that, at least on a consistent basis. The beauty of the film in this particular moment is that, you know, his success does, in fact, open up a space, you know, for the Julie Dashes of the world and folks like that to come in and really draw more fuller portraits of black women.
I want to ask each of you, does the film hold up for you? Natalie, I think you were grappling with this most acutely and sort of checking your reactions then with your reactions now. Does the film hold up? Does it still tell us something important about today? Or is it most sort of accurate as a picture of then and that particular era?
Probably both. Sorry to be on the fence about that. You know, in some ways, some of the scenes, particularly the tensions between the Korean American shop owners and the residents, and, you know, the shopkeepers who are of different ethnicity than the people in the neighborhoods, those things still happen. The scene with Radio Raheem and trying to get his 20 double D batteries, you know, that happens, I promise, every day. And so, you know, it does hold up in that sense. There are many of these depictions that do. But the overall message, no, not at all, for me anyway. I don't. You know, it's a much more complicated world that we live in, even back then.
Kai Wright, does the film hold up?
I think it does. I'd have to disagree with Natalie. I think it matters. The question is, what do you consider the film's message? And I don't actually agree that the film is a black nationalist manifesto. I think it's a critique of black nationalism. I think it's a really quite thoughtful challenge to the way we all view race and interaction across race. And I think that while part of it is a Black Nationalist Manifesto, part of it is an indictment of knee-jerk ideas around race relations. The thing that I feel the most at the end of the film is regret. And I think that everyone seems to feel that regret and doesn't know what to do with it now because it's already, you've made the mess, you know, and now we've made it and now we got to wallow in it. And so we'll wallow forward in time. And I think we have continued to wallow forward in time around our knee-jerk ideas of race relations. And so in that sense, I think it holds up quite well.
Mark Anthony Neal, does the film hold up? And I must put you on the spot as the person who teaches Black popular culture. Do you teach the film, and what do you teach about it?
I'm actually teaching a Spike Lee course in the fall here at Duke. And I think it's a period piece. There's no question about that. And if you're trying really to give a representation of where Black cultural nationalism in particular was at a particular point in time, I think the film does a wonderful job of that. But I'm with Kai on this, and I think that Spike Lee is really offering a much more complex critique. I think part of what he was challenged with at the time, you know, this is his third feature film. And he's really at this mode, how much of what I want to think about can I get into this film? Not knowing that there may be 12 or 13 more films down the road. And that kind of sense of urgency that Spike Lee had as a filmmaker at that point in time, I think the fact that the film is pregnant with so many ideas, many of them contradictory, you know, speaks to the fact that he was just trying to get his message out there as effectively as he could.
Mark Anthony Neal teaches Black popular culture, among other things, at Duke University, and he writes a blog called New Black Man. He joined us from Durham. Kai Wright is a senior writer for TheRoot.com. He joined us from our New York bureau. And Natalie Hopkinson is the associate editor for TheRoot.com. She joined us in her Washington, D.C. studio. And we'll have a link to The Root's commemorative web feature marking the 20th anniversary of Do the Right Thing on our website. There you'll find links to all of the essays, including those we just discussed. Plus, for the hip-hop junkies out there, check out NPR's online tribute to the iconic boombox. That's all on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Tell Me More. And I thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.